Welcome to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable, where we catch up on the Ohio politics news of last week and preview the week ahead. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Joining me this morning to talk all things Ohio politics are Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Happy Monday, Laura.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Jake Zuckerman, State House reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Jake.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
And Megan Henry, State House reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. Hi.
Good morning. Good to be here.
The fight over redistricting is headed to court again. This time, it's over how the amendment to rewrite how we draw district lines will be described when we all go vote on November. The Attorneys for Citizens Not Politicians, which is the group pushing this a new amendment, described the language chosen by Republican Secretary of State Frank LaRose like this.
The language is stunning in it being false and misleading, and it is unabashed in terms of its prejudicial language. There's no reasonable person who could read that language and after reading that draft language could conclude that it is an honest attempt to craft unbiased, fair ballot language that allows voters to make independent decisions about the issue. Rather, I would describe the language as a farce of Shakespearean proportion.
Jake, how important is the language that we see appear on the screen when we go and vote?
You know, it's important at least at the margins. I mean, I don't know exactly how poll tested it is, but if you talk to any pollster, you know, the way you frame and ask a question is going to greatly influence the results you get back. So when you look at the ballot language that the ballot board passed and their references to, a taxpayer-funded board, the Ohio Redistricting Commission as it is now is taxpayer-funded. So it's kind of both are equally taxpayer-funded. But when you start throwing words in there, you know, you can just trigger things in people's taxpayer-funded. Wait, what is this new government board you're forming? So I think that you can just sort of steer people in asking the question toward a certain answer. And I think you can make a pretty good case that that's what this language is doing.
Yeah, the opening of this language says the proposed amendment would repeal constitutional protections against gerrymandering approved by nearly three quarters of Ohio electors participating in the statewide elections of 2015 and 2018, and eliminate the longstanding ability of Ohio citizens to hold their representatives accountable. Laura, that is a choice in the opening lines of that language.
Well, I think Jake's right. The way you frame a question can influence the outcome of how people vote on it, right?
Yeah, and repeal protections against gerrymandering, that sounds bad, objectively.
Sure. I think it's a reference to, you know, this would supersede the anti-gerrymandering protections that were passed in 2015 and 2018.
It's a repeal and replace, essentially.
Correct. And the advocates for this, the Citizens Not Politicians group, say that the 2015 and 2018 reforms just didn't quite do it, and we have to fully replace politicians from this process because of the way it was interpreted the last time.
This is a complicated amendment, and I would just like to say I recommend everyone who plans to vote on it take time before you go to the poll, read about it, make up your mind, right, Megan? You shouldn't be showing up reading any sort of ballot summary and then making a decision.
That's right. Yeah, the hope is that voters would go into the polls on election day, or they vote beforehand and know which way they're going to vote. But if someone is kind of on the fence or maybe isn't quite as knowledgeable about it beforehand and they read that loaded language, then they could be persuaded one way or the other.
Republican Senator Teresa Gavarone sits on the ballot board. She voted for the language that was approved, and she went through a laundry list of reasons why she thinks the language is accurate.
It accurately describes the complex and partisan selection process for commission members, some of which is accomplished by blind draw. It accurately details the impasse procedure, which uses a ranked choice selection process for adopting district plans, as well as a random process to settle ties. It accurately describes the limitation placed on the citizenry with respect to expressing their opinions and ideas to commission members and staff during the redistricting process or regarding redistricting plans.
Jake, you know, Gaveron kept going back and back to the idea that they were being accurate, but I do think it's possible to be both accurate and misleading, as anybody who's ever tried to parse data, because I've been thinking about this in my head, and, you know, if I were to tell you that Schindler's List was a movie about a man who made a list and checked it twice, I would be accurate, but I would also be wildly misleading.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I want to touch Schindler's List,
no.
But I would absolutely agree that, yeah, it's not that there's anything, I'm seeing this ballot language, like, you know, wrong, fact check, that's untrue. But again, it just comes back to soliciting a certain kind of response from this stuff. And, you know, I think that if you wanted to make a neutral presentation, this comes off as more of a campaign ad. You know, when you see campaign ads on TV, by and large, they must be true. You must be able to point to some basis of fact and say, this is where that's coming from. But when you watch a campaign ad, they're anything but neutral. You're like, I don't want that. That sounds real bad. So again, it just comes back to fomenting, I don't know, like a circumstance where a reader of this thing comes away with a desired opinion. I think that's what's going on here.
Laura, when did the ballot board become so political? I feel like it used to be this sort of sleepy technocratic thing where we just decide language for the ballot.
Yeah, I mean, the ballot board used to be something you didn't even go attend. You just sort of check on it later to see what they did. The ballot board was created in 1974 by a constitutional amendment, and it's two Democrats, two Republicans, and it's chaired by the Secretary of State. Mike Curtin, who is the former publisher of the Dispatch, Columbus Dispatch, and a former state lawmaker, and also author of Ohio Politics Almanac, hard to say that word, he has a column in the Dispatch today that gives some good historical context about the ballot board, and his column says that Frank LaRose has really kind of tipped the scales in toward partisanship, and that the ballot board used to be kind of an honest broker of ballot language. Before the ballot board was created, voters would have to read the entire text, or maybe a condensed text of constitutional amendments, and sometimes these things go on and on, and they're really technical, and so the ballot board was designed to, you know, help the voter understand how this amendment would operate. And under Curtin's, you know, theory or thesis in his column is that Frank LaRose has really shoved it into a partisan operation.
The Secretary of State did say, quote, "It is what I genuinely believe to be our best effort to truthfully summarize a very long amendment for the voters." But Megan, this is going to court, so we'll have to see ultimately what happens here.
Yeah, we'll see how this plays out. And this has happened before, where the ballot board has come forward and there's been a controversial language. We saw that last year with issue one.
Which was the reproductive rights amendment.
Yes, that is correct. And so this has kind of been there, done that before when it comes to this kind of language.
This is issue one again, so in case anyone's confused.
And something I'd add there is, when you think back to the abortion amendment going through the ballot board, for one, the proponents of that said, let's just skip this foofy ballot language. Let's put the amendment that's
a
really simple. It's short. It's a simple, you know, you read it and you can understand it, which A, it's interesting that they just wanted the raw ballot text. But B, I would call this a very technocratic process. And like, there's no great way to say this is how we're going to fundamentally change this weird redistrict. You know, it's a very complex system. It doesn't lend itself to a succinct explanation that I think even people who study and follow politics pretty closely, redistricting is, you know, it happens once every 10 years. I mean, how many people are really up to snub on the ins and outs of it?
I think that people are following redistricting far more now than they did 10 or 20 years ago,
yeah,
or 30 years ago, because it is something that is, I think, more translatable, and people see the results of gerrymandering in their state legislatures across the country of, you know, highly partisan representation.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I'm sure you know this well, but, you know, in the 2010s, that was a very sleepy and I say sleepy as in people weren't paying attention to it, but that was a Republican goal, is win control of state houses around the country and control the redistricting process, and the Democrats were caught sleeping and got wiped out at these state houses.
Well, the Democrats got they had won the governorship and Secretary of State and a couple other I think they swept all the offices except for auditor. Mary Taylor won. And I think that they were kind of emboldened and they wanted to go for broke, and they thought that they could win those offices again in a redistricting year, and they did not. It turned out to be a very bad year for the Democrats to...
Not only here in Ohio, but 2010 was a bad year for Democrats nationally.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the vice presidential debate. J.D. Vance and Tim Walz have agreed to debate. The Midwestern matchup will be hosted by CBS News on October 1st. Vance wants two debates, though, and has floated the idea of doing one with CNN in September. Laura, it would be silly to ask whether debates matter this year, but the stakes are different for vice presidential debates, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, it has been like a sleepy, who cares kind of event, almost pro forma. But given how Biden, the debate was such a huge turning point in this election, I think that there's some thought of, you know, maybe every debate now actually matters, even the vice presidential debates. And it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting matchup for Walz and Vance, both Midwestern guys.
Both trying to be the every guy,
America,
the guy you want to have a beer with.
Right, America's dad, family values kind of thing. And I think that they have, you know, similar experiences. They're both veterans. So anyway, it'll be an interesting matchup for sure.
Yeah, a new Washington Post ABC Ipsos poll finds that Americans seem to like Walz better than Vance, at least right now. 32% have a favorable impression of Vance, while 42% do not. Walz's favorability is at 39, while his negative is at 30. But I would point out that a quarter of Americans still haven't made up their minds about either man yet. So I guess we're still trying to figure out as a country who is J.D. Vance and who is Tim Walz.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's tougher being an Ohioan because we've all been familiar with J.D. Vance at least since 2016. I guess one thing I've been kind of curious about, it, not that this really answers the question, but J.D. Vance, you know, when you think about when Hillbilly Elegy came out and he was doing the media rounds, whatever his ideology may or may not have changed, he was nicer. Like, I mean, he was softer. You just got the sense of this more... Like, I never would imagine him using these kind of, like, personal insults that you hear. I mean, childish cat ladies being the most prominent one. But there are other – he's just, like, an icier guy than I remember. And I'm curious if that's a human metamorphosis or is that political shtick? And do people like – do people still want that kind of mean in their politics?
Well, we'll have to see at the debate because Tim Walz definitely has mastered the Midwestern nice.
Yeah, and that's – I mean, what a contrast, right?
Yeah. I want to move on to abortion. So a Hamilton County judge is expected to rule on whether Ohio's heartbeat law is now unconstitutional. The law, which would ban almost all abortions after 6 weeks, has been on hold for nearly 2 years. It was first challenged for violating our Healthcare Freedom Amendment and now for violating the new Reproductive Rights Amendment that voters passed last year. Laura, it's expected that this law, this heartbeat law, will be struck down. Do we know if Attorney General Dave Yost will appeal this decision?
You know, I don't know. I covered in a different abortion court case this past week in which there was a challenge to the 24-hour waiting period law. Mm-hmm. And we are, you know, the Yost has weighed in and said that it should be maintained. And this is about informed consent and protecting the patient. And the ACLU and the abortion clinics and one abortion provider doctor have challenged the law and said, you know, there's no other medical procedure that has a mandatory 24-hour waiting period. This old law, I think there's like three iterations of it that date back as like more than three decades, that it violates the new amendment. And so I think that's in the abortion news. I think that's what we're going to see first is a ruling from Franklin County Common Pleas Court Judge David Young.
And Megan, you also wrote about an uptick in the number of out-of-state travelers coming to Ohio for abortions. What's going on there?
Yes. So three of the neighboring states around Ohio, Kentucky, Indiana, and West Virginia have near total abortion bans. There are some exceptions. They vary by state for rape and incest, depending on the state. But because of these near total abortion bans, people are coming from out of state to Ohio as an abortion destination of sorts to receive an abortion. But because of, as Laura was mentioning, the 24-hour waiting period, those folks have to physically go to the clinic twice, and that can take a lot of time and travel and can get very expensive.
You might need a hotel room to stay overnight.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, so it can be very expensive. And too, Ohio has six surgical abortion clinics in various parts of the state. And so, but some areas of the state are lacking clinics, such as Southeast Ohio, where Athens is, and then Northwest Ohio, where the Toledo area is, are actually lacking these surgical abortion centers. So folks in those corners of the state either have to travel far distances in Ohio or might look to Pennsylvania or Michigan to receive that care.
I gotta say, Ohio being a destination for abortion was not on my 2024 bingo card. But I guess it makes sense if we're up to viability right now because the heartbeat law has been essentially on permanent hold.
Yeah, I was surprised to see these numbers and do this data as well as I set out to do this reporting. So it was interesting to see. But I think it's really because of last year, issue one passing, that it has become this sort of destination spot, so to speak.
Coming up, how Ohio spent nearly $1 billion on private school vouchers. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable, an hour where we talk all things Ohio politics. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us are Laura Bischoff, politics and state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Jake Zuckerman, State House reporter for Cleveland.com, and Megan Henry, State House reporter for the Ohio Capital Journal. The Democratic National Convention kicks off today in Chicago. The latest polling shows Vice President Kamala Harris with a slight lead over Donald Trump. Harris has 49% to Trump's 45% among registered voters in a head-to-head matchup. And while many Ohio Democrats are dusting off their suits and their silly hats and heading to the convention floor, Senator Sherrod Brown is not going. Laura, do we know if he has any other plans for this week, or is he just kind of laying low?
I saw in an email blast that he was out canvassing in, I think, the Dayton area over the weekend. My colleague Jesse Balmert is at the DNC this week, and she has a story about how actually Sherrod Brown skipping the convention kind of fits in with a couple other senators who are in tight election bids. Jackie Rosen in Nevada and John Tester in Montana also are skipping the convention. And I think it's just sort of indicative of how they want to run their own races and maybe don't want to be tied too closely to Harris and Walz, that it works better for them to just, operate their own strategy.
Yeah, it's the opposite, though, of what happened at the RNC. Bernie Moreno, the Republican challenging Brown, not only went, but he was a surrogate for Trump throughout the convention, and he had a primetime speaking slot. So he did everything he could to be seen and at that convention. It's probably just Jake simply, he thinks that's going to help him this November.
Yeah, I mean, I think the math is simple enough. Like, if you're Sherrod Brown, and right now the smart money says Trump will probably win Ohio, then you need people who are going to vote for Trump to also vote for you, so you don't want to hitch your wagon too closely to Joe Biden. You know, there's nothing supernatural here. Same with John. I'm sure John Tester's doing the same analysis.
Yeah, and Rosen in Nevada. So school is back in session across Ohio, and while it's a new academic year, Ohio is still totaling up what it paid out from last year. The latest estimate is that we paid $960 million in EdChoice scholarships. That's the name for Ohio's school voucher program, which covers tuition for kids who attend private schools. Megan, $960 million is a lot of money, but it is less than earlier estimates, so we're coming in kind of right on budget here.
That's right. Yeah, it's just under, but still, that is a lot more than we saw in years previously, too. And so just with the new school year starting up, one can only expect it'll be even higher after this school year we're about to embark on. Anna, we were chatting briefly about how there really hasn't seen a decline in students attending public schools. So it seems to be that a lot of this money is going to students who are already attending private schools.
Yeah, last year was the first year that we had universal voucher, which means every Ohio student was eligible for some amount of money. It sort of steps down based on your income. But yeah, without a significant dip in overall public school enrollment, logic would sort of tell us, Jake, that the majority, if not almost all, of these new scholarships, this new spending, was kids already in private school.
Yeah, I think that's right. What I'm curious in the out years is, you know, you could see, like, if you're a student in third or seventh grade, you know, maybe you don't want to transfer schools when you're in the middle of that block, you know, K through five, middle school, et cetera. Mm. But I'm just wondering if over time, all right, I'm through elementary school, I'm already going to a new school, this money's on the table. Is that going to entice people over, or will these vouchers really just always stay confined to people who are already in private school?
That's an interesting question, because a lot of times we see kids drop out when it gets to high school because high school tuition at private schools tends to be more expensive. But with these new vouchers, I wonder if that'll stop, or maybe we will see kids like enter into private high school. But it might be a couple years before we can really look at that data and have any kind of educated guess about what's happening. Speaking of money of a different kind, Ohio dispensaries raked in $11.5 million from their first week of recreational cannabis sales. For context, Illinois sold slightly less than $1 million during its first week. So we made a good amount of money in that very first week, and it seems like it went off without any real issues or hiccups or outside of a couple of price spikes.
Yeah, that's a lot of weed. That's a lot of weed that was sold. I was there at some dispensaries on the first day of recreational marijuana sales, and the lines, let me tell you, they were snaked around these buildings. So there was lots of demand. The dispensaries I talked to had actually extended hours. They opened earlier than normal, and they were going to stay open later. There were almost 100 dispensaries at that moment that were able to sell recreational marijuana, whereas some other states, when they start legalizing recreational marijuana, they might have only a handful of dispensaries able to sell recreational marijuana. But Ohio had nearly 100 who had the availability because of the licensing at that point. Doesn't mean that every single one necessarily was open that day to sell recreational, but that was just a lot of dispensaries across the state who were able to.
And for anyone who had sticker shock, it is anticipated that the prices will start to go down in the next couple weeks to months.
That's my understanding, yes. But there was a spike right before recreational sales
It's supply
started.
And demand.
Exactly.
Essentially. Moving on, Jobs Ohio is asking to extend its lease on our state liquor profits for another 15 years. So if you don't know, Jobs Ohio is a nonprofit that a couple years ago paid a lump sum to buy our liquor profits. This was back when Kasich was governor, and the idea was that they'd use that income to help get businesses off the ground across the state. Now, their lease doesn't end until 2038, so Jake, why do they want to extend it now?
The getting's good. I'll tell you, the actual mechanism for the extension was through the controlling board, which I would just call a lesser scrutinized part of government. You know, I mean, you've really got to kind of know how a state government works to be paying attention there. And just a little bit of backstory is Bride Rose Sweeney, who is a Democratic representative on the board, when this popped up on agenda, started calling reporters. I would call her like a real motivating force. She seemed to engage Jay Edwards, who's the Republican House Finance Chairman.
He's had long-term concerns about Jobs Ohio.
Yeah, who has never been shy to say, you know, Jobs Ohio, I've heard him say, is just like leaving Southeast Ohio out to dry. So I think they have some political enemies, and they seem to have whipped up some resistance to punt this for the time being. I guess it could come back on any agenda, but now it seems to be at least in the mainstream and getting the scrutiny. So as to your question, why now? I don't know. It's a good question, but I think there's something to the fact that nobody was paying attention when this first popped up.
Yeah, Edwards and Sweeney both say they have questions for Jobs Ohio and they want them answered before they'll agree to renew this lease. But again, they haven't told 2038 to get those questions answered because that's arguably when their rights to our liquor profits would dissipate. So, I mean, there is time. We don't technically have to do this now. I believe Jobs Ohio has said extending it further would give them more certainty in luring mega projects like Intel. But, I mean, they got time, right?
Yeah, 2038. That's still a long runway there. I think that you know, if they're going to make a change like this, putting it through the controlling board, which as Jake says, is a little less scrutiny. It's also known for being a place where you can get changes done a lot quicker. You know, maybe it deserves an airing out through the entire legislative process rather than going through the controlling board.
Yeah, we'll have to see. But, I mean, if Edwards and Sweeney, I mean, they're the chair and vice chair of this committee, if they're both on board with not bringing it up, they have a lot of latitude to just not bring it up.
Yeah, I get, this is beyond my knowledge of state government is how to kill something from inside the bowels of the controlling board. But, yeah, those are definitely two pretty powerful actors there.
Yeah. So a Texas-based energy company has won the rights to drill for oil and gas underneath the Keene Wildlife Area in Hamilton, in Harrison County. Megan, you were at the meeting, so what happened?
Yes, so this was a very quick and straightforward meeting. I think it lasted all about 15, 20 minutes. And so the
unusual for this commission hearings lately.
Yes, yes. And so the oil and gas commission members went through the agenda. They voted yes on nearly everything. But throughout the meeting, people who were against fracking, the anti-fracking folks, were in the back, which is customary, holding signs and you know, shouting questions and trying to interject and bring attention to fracking incidents and accidents and things that have gone wrong because of fracking, not only in Ohio, but also just in general. Those interjections were mostly ignored, except for asking people to, you know, be quiet, basically so they can continue their meeting. But that's pretty much how the last few meetings have been going on, where things will just pass pretty straightforward, despite calls for them to not pass these things.
And Jake, this is a long time coming. They put these out for bid many months ago, the bids came in, and now they're essentially awarding rights to the winners.
Yeah. And something I'd add here is if you look through the public comments on that, I don't want to say universal because I didn't read every single one of them, but I spent a good 10 minutes leafing through hundreds of individuals, you know, and it's hard to make a statement about the entirety of them. I did not see one person in there saying, please come frack this wildlife area. You know, we need this. The park, the wildlife area needs the money. They get some share of the profits. So, I mean, I think we have a pretty clear showing of, for better or for worse, a government is really acting over the whims of everyone who decided to participate in that process.
And speaking of that process, there won't be any charges for an oil and gas group that used the names of real Ohioans to create a false impression that these people supported fracking underneath our state parks. Jake, why did the Attorney General not press charges for this?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, to the AG's credit, they're running an administrative rule which would at least more specifically say that this kind of conduct is illegal. But by their analysis, what this – you could call it the Consumer Energy Alliance, which is a 501c4 nonprofit, but really it's an operation run out of a Houston-based PR firm. And they say what they did is, to borrow the words of the AG's office, sneaky but not illegal. They – funneled people on from these, I'd call them get-rich-quick kind of websites. You know, your opinion matters, and if you put in your basic information and answer a question or two, you could win a free vacation to Italy, that kind of thing. And that is the basis for, you get my name, you get my address, you get my phone number, and it's only after you've affirmatively clicked some fine print that nobody reads that you learn that you have actually submitted a public comment to this state board.
Oh my goodness.
And you can only see a copy of the letter after, and that's according to the Attorney General, after you have agreed and the comment has been submitted. So they're saying because these people technically did see some opt-out language that they didn't read, it's probably not illegal. If you read the rule, the rule is pretty tight. There's no penalty attached to it. But I think the big thing to keep your eyes on here is PR firms don't just do PR work willy-nilly. They're not – it's not coded
into
their DNA.
This wasn't for funsies.
Yeah, this wasn't a freebie. Somebody in all likelihood paid them to do this, and we – Dave Yost's investigation did not determine who that person is. And since that time, there have been, let's see, 3 wildlife areas and 1 state park that have been bid off, and the rights under them are sold. We don't know if one of those people who won this contract did so by doing this quote-unquote sneaky but not illegal lobbying work. So
I would also point out that, like, no one would know about this sneaky but not illegal behavior had it not been for press attention. And I think, Jake, it was your story that came out. Like, you did the hard work of, you know, digging in and finding out, well, what's actually going on here? And so kudos to you.
Yeah, and I guess it makes sense. It essentially, if I'm understanding you correct, it comes down to the fact that the attorney general doesn't think there's a crime by the letter of the law. That doesn't mean that he thinks what they did was okay. It's just sometimes things that are not exactly ethical are still legal.
If I could just give an example here to say what we're talking about. I'm not going to use her name. There's no need to put a child's name on the air. But there was a child. Well, there was a person who was named on one of these letters, and if you read the letters, it reads like ChatGPT, just like ChatGPT, like, write me a letter that says I support fracking at State Park. It just doesn't sound like human language. And eventually, I got in touch with what turned out to be this letter writer's mother, who said, no, my daughter did not write that letter. She's 9 years old. She's never been to Salt Fork. She's never heard of fracking. She has no political opinions on any of this. She's 9. And in any event, The Ohio Oil and Gas Land Management Commission eventually took that letter. I mean, it took weeks for that letter to come down. But in any event, that's the kind of stuff we're talking about. I think the likely event is she used her mom's laptop for something, you know, found one of these websites. Her name gets on there. The Consumer Energy Alliance, the people behind this, or HBW Resources, the PR firm, whichever name you want to use, they still maintain this position of, like, we didn't use anyone's names without permission. I'll leave that to listeners to decide.
Maybe the ChatGPT question should have been, write me a letter from the point of view of a 9-year-old who supports fracking.
Oh, that would be a fun query. I'd love to see how that comes out. I may have to do that after we're off air just to see what ChatGPT spits out.
But in any event, you know, you talk to enough lawyers, maybe they can give you a convincing explanation of how this is legal behavior. If you talk to this girl's mother, her mother's name is Brittany Keep, she'll say, how is this not illegal? Somebody took my 9-year-old's identity and put it on a lobbying letter. How is this legal conduct?
Yeah, so I think maybe the life lesson here is be careful when you sign up and give your information for these giveaways.
Those sound tempting, though. Like, I see how people can
free vacation.
Can
you just
it.
Need your name and address. You could end up writing a letter in support of fracking to the Oil and Gas Commission.
And it speaks to what kinds of people are getting suckered into, you know, I mean, who is being targeted here?
That was Jake Zuckerman, Statehouse reporter for Cleveland.com. Coming up, we're talking what happened, or the latest update on First Energy in the ongoing saga over the nuclear bailout. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
New from The Embedded podcast. Female athletes have always needed grit and talent. But for decades, they've also needed a certificate.
There was chit-chat about, is that really a woman?
And even now, they're still being checked and questioned. Their story is the newest series from CBC and NPR's Embedded. It's called Tested. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us this hour is Laura Bischoff from the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Jake Zuckerman from Cleveland.com, and Megan Henry from the Ohio Capital Journal. In a move that can only be described as turnabout is fair play, Democrats in Mahoning County are challenging a Republican candidate for using his nickname on the ballot. Austin James. Texford Fisher goes by Text, and that is what will appear on the ballot this November. But Jake, Democrats are saying, hold on a minute, that is only his legal name very recently.
Yeah, yeah. In 2020, he changed his name. Well, he, I don't know if you'd call it changed his name. He gave himself a second middle name of Texford. He said that he's been known by Tex since he was a child. And yeah, Democrats.
He just wanted to make it official.
Sure. Ironically, he said he thought it would make life easier just to make that a legal name. Now, around the state, there have been three transgender Democratic candidates who did not disclose their former names. And we all learned that there's a 1996 law that says you must disclose any legal name change within the last 5 years. Two of those candidates, after the challenges, did still make the ballot, but one of them didn't. And I think that that really ruffled some Democratic feathers. They'd say this is a totally arbitrary reason to deprive someone of the right to run. And I think they're saying, well, if you're going to use that on us, we're going to use that on the young Texford here. And they filed a challenge with the Mahoning County Board of Elections. Boards of elections are usually they're partisan, but they're two Democrats, two Republicans. They tied. They issued, the tie is going to be broken by Secretary of State Frank LaRose. But the facts are cut and dry. It says if in within the last 5 years, if you've changed your name and didn't disclose it, you can't run for office. You have to return any salary under which you earned after you were elected. Representative Fisher was appointed, not elected. So I don't know how they square that one. But in any event, what do you do about that one? And there's not a great, you know, I mean, I think Democrats kind of squirmed when you asked them, I mean, what's the right answer here? Is it better to keep a Republican off the ballot for this kind of silly reason because that's fair's fair and it happened to a Democrat? Or do you apply this kind of, again, silly law evenly and just keep two deserving people off the ballot?
The idea being, I think, right, the heart of the law, Laura, sounds to be that we should know who's running, that you shouldn't, like, say, do terrible bad things and then change your name and try to hide your identity, essentially.
Right. Typically when you change your name, you have to go to court. File some paperwork and
public notice it. It's a whole process.
And it's to guard against fraud. And I think that this law is also to guard against fraud and duping the voters, you know, that, you know, somebody, is not a good candidate and just has a fresh start with a fresh name and, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't know how silly the law is. I think that maybe people should be more aware of it. And then
wasn't that one of the things I think, Megan, that came up with these transgender candidates is that it's not part of like the Secretary of State's like booklet or list of rules for candidates. Like it really wasn't publicized very clearly for anyone who might need that information.
That's right. I feel like it was like a little known law that really until these transgender candidates started filing that this kind of caused a kerfuffle and was people were made aware of this.
Because it doesn't apply to people who get married, right? Like if a lawmaker gets married and takes their partner's name, that name change law doesn't apply, correct?
That's correct.
Yeah. I guess so. I'd wouldn't have come up earlier, essentially.
I guess more than silly, I'd say there's definitely a legitimate anti-fraud interest. And Rep. Fisher also made the example, like, what if someone just changed their name to Donald Trump?
Yeah.
Someone appealing in Ohio. You could see how there are problems. I guess I mean silly in the sense that there doesn't seem to be any notion of duplicity here.
There's no malicious
intent. There are
people
changing their genders or some guy giving himself a nickname that he's had since he was a child. That is, I guess, what I'm pointing at when I say it's silly.
But to Megan's point, maybe there just should be more publicizing for people who are interested in running for various offices that, hey, by the way, FYI, if you've changed your name in the last 5 years, you have to do this.
Yeah, and you get a lot of latitude on how your name actually appears on the election ballot. You can use a middle name. You can use a nickname. Like,
yeah, I think like Mike DeWine appears on the ballot as Mike DeWine, not Richard Michael DeWine.
Yeah, there's lots of lawmakers like that. I knew one in Oregon who was Gene Wisnett. Gene was his middle name because Cletus was his first name, and man, I do not blame him for going with Gene Wisnett.
I think Rep. Fisher is in Al Catrona's old seat, if I'm not mistaken, and he's actually Alessandro Catrona.
There
Fun
you go.
Example.
Yeah, I think a lot of lawmakers choose a nickname or run with a middle name, and that's pretty common. Do we know yet? I mean, I guess it's up to Frank LaRose to make this ultimate call.
Yep, it goes to the secretary.
So First Energy is going to pay a $20 million fine to Ohio for its role in the nuclear bailout scandal that sent former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder to prison. Laura, why are some Democrats unhappy with this fine and this outcome?
I haven't talked to the Democrats about why they might be unhappy. I think that this is kind of, it follows the federal case in which FirstEnergy paid a $230 million fine to avoid prosecution and to agree to cooperate. And I think that that's, it's not surprising that FirstEnergy would choose to, you know,
pay
the fine, you know, turn over the records, et cetera, and work with the AG's office and the Summit County Prosecutor's Office. So I don't think it's surprising at all. You know, this saga has gone on for 4 years now, I think.
Well, I guess five if you include the passage of HB 6.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Even going back further, if you, you know, look at Householder's
the origin
alliance,
story here.
Yeah, his alliance with the FirstEnergy folks. And I, you know, maybe it's not done. We'll see where the Yost investigation goes. And then, you know, whether or not Ken Parker, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Ohio, if his team is going to ever bring charges against the guys who orchestrated the bribe paying.
Yeah. Former FirstEnergy executives Chuck Jones and Mike Dowling have only been charged at the state level, and they've pleaded not guilty to charges of corruption, bribery, and money laundering. So their cases are ongoing at the state level, but maybe, Jake, one day they'll be charged at the federal level. I mean, kind of only have until the end of the year, right?
Yeah, I mean, statutes of limitations, there's play in the joints. There are ways you can get around them. But there is something called the Petit Principle, which if in the U.S. attorney handbooks that they give out, the Petit Principle basically says you're not supposed to go where a state prosecutor has gone. So here a state prosecutor has charged Jones and Dowling for this conduct. It's not black letter. It's not something that can never be overcome, but it basically says respect a sovereign state government. Let states try to clean up their own act first. Let the state go. Now, you can overcome that if you think justice won't be done at the state level, if you think a state's incapable or if you have other conduct. But that's just one factor to consider. But I think, you know, myself and others have spent a long time trying to figure out what is going on out of this U.S. attorney's office. They're sending some signals that say we're done, we're moving on, and some signals that say this is an open investigation. If anybody knows, my phone's open. Call me.
Yeah. And Laura, retired FBI agent Jeff Williams joined the Ohio Politics Explained podcast from the USA Today network recently, and he detailed lessons learned from earlier public corruption cases. It's a great listen for anybody who'd like to. But can you tell us a little bit about the case of Amar Ahmed?
Yeah, he used to be he was the CFO for the state treasurer's office under originally Richard Cordray, Democrat, and then he stayed on when Kevin Boyce became the state treasurer by appointment. And he operated up until that point, it had been the biggest bribery and kickback scheme in state history. He rewrote the state's investment policy so that there'd be lots and lots of trading and lots of fees generated. And then he put his high school friend on the trading list. Mm. And this guy, Doug Hampton, he made I think $3.2 million off of the trades that were steered his way. And then he kicked back like $525,000 to Ahmed. And
can't do that.
And he did it through a couple of different conduits. There were four people who were charged in it, two Doug and this other guy, Joe, the lawn guy. They pled guilty initially. And then Noor Alu and Ahmad ended up pleading guilty a little bit later. And, you know,
Didn't he try to flee at one point?
Well, yeah. So Kevin Boyce didn't win retention, and Josh Mandel became the state treasurer. And Ahmad went on to be the comptroller for the city of Chicago. So anyway, he went back to Chicago under Rahm Emanuel, who was the mayor at the time. And so anyway, they in federal court, oftentimes they'll allow people out pre-sentencing, like go back, take care of your affairs, etc.
It's a white-collar crime. It's not violent. They're like, right, okay, just go get your stuff together.
Yeah, well, he got his stuff together, and he cashed out his accounts, and he put a bunch of cash in a roller bag, and he flew from Chicago Midway to San Diego, and then he went from there, took a taxi to the Tijuana border, walked into Mexico, took a flight to Mexico City, went to the Pakistani embassy and said his name was somewhere else, and he needed a new passport. And the Pakistani embassy is like, this is going to take a while. No. And so he went to his taxi driver, Eduardo, and asked for a fake passport. And so he gets a fake passport. He flies to Lahore, Pakistan on the fake passport. And the authorities there intercept him. And by now, Interpol has put out a red letter notice saying, like, oh no, we lost this guy. And, you know, he's not Pakistani. He was born in Canton, Canton, Ohio. And so anyway, so he, you know, he continues to insist that he's Faisal somebody or other, and and he's not going to come back. And he ends up spending, I think, 15 months in a Pakistani jail. U.S. District Court Judge Mike Watson sentenced him in absentia. And then finally he gave up his farce, and he came back, and he went to federal prison, and it remains one of my favorite and most interesting stories.
That is a wild story.
Yeah, wow.
Fascinating
story.
Yeah, and Jeff Williams was the FBI public corruption team leader during that whole investigation, and you know his team had to go collect him from the Middle East, and it was just crazy, and yeah, it was a great story.
Yeah, I had no idea that you could get through TSA with a suitcase full of cash, but
well, yeah, I guess you want
a long time ago. I guess
it was post 9/11 though, right?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
That is surprising then. Yes.
Well, who knows? He made it. He got there. And eventually he ended up coming home. I'm surprised. Like, I don't know much about Pakistani prison, but I don't think that he was having a good time for those 15 months.
No, he was not. And when he returned to federal court, he looked much thinner than I had known him to be.
So this is the third week that we're talking about this, but Laura, the Ohio Supreme Court decision that boneless chicken can have bones in it has made its way to the late night talk show circuit. Host Stephen Colbert had a bit of fun with it. Here's what he had to say.
Listen to this hot legal garbage. The justices of the Ohio Supreme Court argue that people don't expect boneless wings to be actually boneless, just as a person eating chicken fingers would know that he had not been served fingers. Yeah, because newsflash, chickens don't have f-ing fingers.
Exactly.
But they do
exactly.
have bones.
So it seems that the rest of the country is having a little bit of fun with this boneless debate, but there actually is a lawmaker here, a Democrat, who wants to introduce a law that would bring common sense to the court. Probably not going anywhere.
Well, you know, there was two things with this. One, the main legal question on this was whether or not the case should have gone to a jury.
Mm.
And, you know, the guy who ate the chicken wings, the wing was like kind of embedded and it sort of sprung open and it ripped apart his
esophagus.
Oh, it
was serious injury.
And, yeah, he was in a coma for a while. I mean, he was in bad shape. And so the question was, you know, was there a negligence claim? But then there's a larger question that I think relates to the public, which is, you know, consumer protection. There are we, when they say fresh squeezed orange juice, is it from 6 months ago? Which is a joke that Colbert made. And I think that this is a case that is easily translatable to the public. Everybody goes out to restaurants. Everybody consumes food. They want to know, is it safe? And I think we're going to hear a lot about it during the election for the Ohio Supreme Court. There's three seats that are being contested.
Yeah, I expect to see the boneless wings make an appearance in campaign ads. Like, this guy said that boneless wings can have bones. Isn't that crazy? You shouldn't vote for him. Who knows if that'll actually stick?
That's right. And as someone who prefers boneless wings, maybe I'm just the odd one. I was very closely paying attention to this outcome of this case.
I know. It's a little unsettling.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what always sticks out in my mind is the hospital bills, you know? I mean, that's no joke. Comatose, I'm sure that's not cheap.
Yeah. And like, yeah, we can all joke about bones and boneless wings, right? But he tore his esophagus. He needed surgery. He was in the hospital. I'm sure it was a painful recovery. So it wasn't just like he kind of choked on it on the way down.
And the jury trial thing is important. That's a constitutional guarantee, and he'll never reach that point.
You know, actually, the cases, the the plaintiff in it has asked for reconsideration of the Supreme Court. So I think it should come back to the court pretty soon. The justices will have to vote on whether or not they want to reconsider.
I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah, often the answer is no. We don't want to reconsider.
So. And last but not least, Laura, we have about 30 seconds left. I'm hoping you can give us a real quick update on STRS.
Yeah, so the State Teachers Retirement System of Ohio, it's the public pension system for 500,000 retirees and teachers. They kind of kicked the can down the road a little bit on what to do with Executive Director Bill Neville. He was placed on administrative leave back in November after there were allegations that he was abusive and
inappropriate
harassment. Yeah. Those allegations were unfounded. The board just hasn't figured out what to do.
So it will continue.
Exactly.
That was Laura Bischoff from the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Jake Zuckerman from Cleveland.com.
Thank you.
And finally, to Megan Henry from the Ohio Capital Journal.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.